to change the world and letters from the inside. That's just a small taste of what this show is about as we seek to expose, agitate, and build. Tune in Monday through Thursday at 8 a.m. on 90.7 or at kpfk.org.
This is KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
You're listening to Fiercely Independent KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles, and on the web at kpfk.org.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week, we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like. There are about 1,300 places in Los Angeles designated as historic cultural monuments. That's LA's version of local landmarks. But less than 3% of them represent women's history. There's a National Trust for Historic Preservation initiative now called Where Women Made History, and it's focusing on recognizing those contributions, all kinds of contributions, to our LA history. And we're joined today by Chris Morris, who leads the program. Welcome to Feminist Magazine, Chris.
Hi, Lynn. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
So I have to start with a question to put this in the big, horrible, terrible, historic political picture right now. In the midst of all these attacks, you know, the DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion attacks, in March this year, Trump signed an executive order called, quote, Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History, end quote, which is part of this whole ongoing war against woke, as they say. Now, this was specifically about negative signage at national parks and actually asking visitors to report text that is, quote, unpatriotic. And there's lots to say, of course, about how DEI also includes women's rights in history. But tell us, how is this big federal shadow affecting your work?
Yeah. No, it's an incredibly important question and a very good one, I think, that everybody is grappling with right now. For your listeners who don't know, the National Trust for Historic Preservation, we're a national advocacy organization. It's really dedicated to saving the places that matter most to our American population here, people of all identities and people of all backgrounds. And of course, women have been a huge part of that work over the years. One of the earliest, quote unquote, preservationists was a woman named Ann Pamela Cunningham, who worked on Mount Vernon. And women often are the people who are leading the work of kind of documenting our history, whether that's familial and informal or whether that's sort of more formal. They're often in positions doing this work in nonprofits across the country. So we often end up being the carriers and bearers of cultural meaning. And so when you think about history, I think it's fairly safe to say that nothing positive has ever come of sort of selectively remembering or selectively telling our history.
Right.
We have been very dedicated as an organization, as have many over the last several decades, to doing what we call telling the full story or telling the full history, really being much more expansive in our understanding of what is quote unquote history. What are the stories, the actions, the places that really help us understand who we are as a people and who we are as a nation? And being incredibly selective about that, particularly with political motivations, is problematic on so many levels because it eliminates so many of the stories and actions that are important to us in terms of understanding how our country came to be. There are lessons for us to learn. You know, those who don't remember history are doomed to repeat it. I don't know who to attribute that to or even how true that is, but there is certainly some truism to it. It's incredibly important for us to understand all of the aspects of our history, good, bad, positive, negative, so that we understand what we've done as a country and how we got to where we are here today. And so many of those stories, so many of those people and those places have been hidden for so long. We're really dedicated to making sure that we're understanding the contributions of people to the historical record. And so sort of saying that we're just going to eliminate, we already don't do a good job of telling those stories, of recognizing the ways that, that women in particular and people of color, indigenous people, have had an enormous impact on the United States and all of our global partners. And we need to do a better job of that, not a worse job of that.
Exactly. And also not having people, quote unquote, snitching about, you know, pieces of history that are uncomfortable to them, right?
Well, it's such a subjective thing. I mean, if you're going to, quote unquote, report on some piece of history, I think you first have to ask, like, why? Like, what is it about that history that you find objectionable? Is it simply because it's forcing you to confront a truth that perhaps you're having trouble reconciling with your own understanding of history? Is it because it's saying something that you feel like is an uncomfortable reflection on America as a place or as a people? Those are incredibly important moments to kind of stop and think, examine, discuss, and learn, not to say, oh, I don't like this, therefore let's just get rid of it and pretend it like it never even happened.
Exactly. And obviously the prime example that I've seen talked about in this story has been about the Manzanar camp and Japanese folk during World War II being held there, mm-hmm. which we're seeing such a reflection of right now again, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah. And the erasure of that history. I mean, I think there seems to be little interest in or compassion for kind of understand the other side of the story. So if you want to erase the history of Manzanar, if you want to erase the history of those tens of thousands of Japanese American immigrants and citizens who are incarcerated, is there any consideration given to whatsoever to the families, the descendants, the people who were directly affected by that act of racism and incarceration?
Exactly. Well, let's move to your program, your initiative, and this like positive, what can we do? Mm-hmm. Which, you know, we love covering stories that are about ways we can actually make change. And you've got a new model for gender equitable designation in LA. How did it start? And what is sort of the main goals of where you're going with this?
Yeah, I'll start with how it started, because I think that kind of gives you some of the bigger picture context, sort of why are we even doing this?
Right.
You mentioned at the top of the show that that LA has 1,300 landmarks, historic cultural monuments, as they call them here in Los Angeles, and that probably somewhere between 2-3% of them are designated for women's history. So this is a program that has been in existence since the 1960s. It was one of the earliest in the country. They've done a great job of doing survey work here in Los Angeles, that pretty much the entire city has been surveyed thanks to Survey LA. So they have an enormous amount of information, a good understanding of the city. They've been doing this work for a long time. And yet, in spite of all of that, less than 3% of the places that they've chosen to designate as reflecting LA's history and culture are sites associated with women. We know there are many, many more than that. And that's a systemic problem. I mean, LA is not unusual in that. I'll put it that way. And it's something that we've discovered in looking at all levels of designation in this country, whether it's the National Register of Historic Places, National Historic Landmarks, both of which are projects at the state and federal level, and other cities that do their own local landmarking process. This number, this 2-4% representation, is very, very typical. It's an incredibly low level of representation. It's also very typical, I should say, for AAPI history, for Latinx history. Like, all quote unquote underrepresented communities are called that because they, you know, they get that moniker because they are woefully underrepresented in the ways that we document and recognize our history. And so the question then became, okay, if we're dealing with this kind of systemic lack of visibility and recognition of women's history from basically the top to bottom, you know, from the federal level all the way down to the local level. What are some ways that we can begin to address that? What are some of the ways that we can begin to fix that? And because I'm based here in Los Angeles and have a good working relationship with the LA Conservancy, which is our local partners, and they do incredible work here across LA County, and with the Office of Historic Resources, which is the governmental entity at the City of Los Angeles that's responsible for doing survey and designation, we thought, why not try to make Los Angeles a model? They're already known across the country for being a leader in survey and designation. They've been doing this work for a very long time. Let's think about what are the problems that are causing this lack of representation? What are the ways in which women's stories are not being told? And then what are some of the changes that we can help initiate in order to try to correct this for the future? And that's exactly what we've done. And that's what we're really hoping, is that Los Angeles then becomes a model for other cities, other preservation commissions, other agencies to look to as a way to begin to kind of undo the way that things have been done for the last 60 plus years.
Right. And before we get into a little bit about sort of the nuts and bolts of how you want to do this differently, tell our listeners, you know, why it matters. Why it matters to kids doing school projects, why it matters to how we think about things for larger political storytelling, all of that.
That is kind of fundamentally what motivates me in this work, is thinking about the larger why. Why do we do this? Why does it matter? And I might not be I might be alone in this way of thinking, but in my mind, if women are not seen, I mean, we are 51% of the human population. So as I like to say, every place has a woman's story to tell. It doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't matter where it is. You can be almost 100% certain that women were there, that women had an impact on that place. And we are just simply not doing a good job of recognizing that. And often women aren't doing a good job of recognizing that. And when you aren't visible, when women's, all of their contributions, their achievements, their struggles, when they aren't visible and they aren't front and center in the ways that people are thinking about our history in place, it makes it that much easier to dismiss women, to dismiss their achievements, to minimize them, and essentially to not see them. It makes it that much easier to hide them or to ignore them. And to me, that is fundamentally problematic. And I don't want to say that there's a direct connection between sort of the political environment and that, but there is definitely some kind of through line between being able to minimize people and then therefore to treat them in ways that are simply unjust. And I don't want to pretend like changing landmarking is going to change that, but if young people, particularly students, we really want to make sure that we're reaching kids in the K through 12 grade levels with this work. If you grow up seeing women as a part of the story, if you grow up understanding that women helped build this city and continue to help build and lead this city, you might have a different understanding of and appreciation of and mindset about the roles that women play in our society, mm-hmm. and the respect that they deserve.
Right. And the potential to be one of those women in your own future, right?
Exactly. I have a friend, I think, I don't know that she originated this, a woman who, Stacey Brightman, who leads the eBell of LA. And she likes to say, you can't be what you can't see. And so really, there have been so many women who have broken barriers, who've done incredibly brave actions over the last you know, century plus here in Los Angeles, and to be able to show young people, both young girls and young boys, that women have taken these stances, that they have broken these barriers, that they have led these causes and efforts, that gives them not only a role model, but it gives them hope for what's possible.
Right. Exactly. So women's history is everywhere in LA, but learning it perhaps in an abstract way and then, but then being able to say, oh, this happened on that street corner or this happened in that building is so much more visceral, I feel. And I know, honestly, every time I go downtown, I purposely pass the Biddy Mason Memorial mm-hmm. because that's so much one of the few that is out there, and actually, and it feels neglected. It feels sort of pushed into a corner between two large buildings, but at the same time, so important. More of that, right?
Yeah, Biddy Mason is a perfect example in some ways. I mean, is a previously enslaved Black woman who then became kind of one of Los Angeles's first real estate magnates, for lack of a better term, is such a remarkable story.
Right.
Unfortunately, there is nothing physically left of the properties that she owned. We know where they were, but the buildings don't exist. And to your point, you know, you can have such a different kind of experience and connection with a person through place. Like, that's kind of the basis of the work that we do in historic preservation, is that places help you understand history differently, help you connect to it much more tangibly. And it's essentially a vessel through which you can understand multiple layers and stories of history. So having that tangible place gives you a very different experience. And that's exactly what we're trying to do, is to help people understand and reframe these places that they may have grown up with, seen, maybe have even visited and heard about, but didn't hear about the women's history connected to those places. So help them get a different understanding and appreciation for those sites, those places that maybe they think they already know, that they only know sort of the tip of the iceberg in terms of the history that's there.
Right. And so your program includes women's history, but also with focus on African-American, API, Latinx, and also LGBTQ histories that are part of that bigger story, right?
Yeah. So, you know, women, anyone dealing with women's history is, you know, it's challenging because women represent all identities and women represent all religious affiliations, all gender, or not all gender identities, but all ethnic identities, all racial identities, all sexuality identities. And so what we're really trying to do is think about all of the different ways that women identify and represent themselves, and not be exclusionary in that. Because if you look at the sites that have already been designated here in the city as historic cultural landmarks connected to women, the vast majority of those few, that 2-3%, are for women's clubs, which are an incredibly important part of women's activism and women's sort of collegiality in the early 20th century. But places like women's clubs and YWCAs tend to tell a very particular story. These are predominantly wealthy white women. And so even within the ways that women's history has been documented so far, it tends to be women of privilege whose histories and stories have been told. And we want to make sure that as we're looking at all the different ways women have impacted LA, that we're thinking about, I mean, this is a city of immigrants. This is a city that has so many people from so many different places here who have contributed to its identity and culture. We want to make sure that we're reflecting that in the work that we do.
Right. We did actually do an interview with the executive director of the Corita Arts Center around the moment when they were fighting to get Sister Corita's studio designated. And, you know, that's like, we have so many moments when we feel, oh, LA is ignored in the national picture, particularly in relation to East Coast cities. And yet here we have a nationally significant woman artist, and that made it seem so much more vital and important to remember that that space, that tiny space right there on, you know, what is it, the corner of Franklin and Western, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's Nellie Scott and the work that she did and all of her collaborators did in trying to save Sister Carita's studio was in many ways the impetus for my thinking on this project.
Okay.
I owe Nellie a great debt for a sort of helping to get the wheels turning. Really made me think for the first time about just exactly how, I mean, we have a woman in Sister Mary Carita who was internationally known. I mean, her influence was so far and wide, encapsulated in this tiny little concrete block building where she created so much of her artwork and taught generations of students. And if someone like Sister Mary Carita, if her reputation, if her impact wasn't being recognized, I mean, what hope could you possibly have for other women who have helped to shape LA for them to be recognized? So I that battle was incredibly important in kind of helping to spark the work that we're doing today through LA Women's Landmarks.
So tell us about the new model. What are you doing differently than has been done before that you're hoping will be this successful template for other places?
So there's multiple components to it. So feel free to stop me if I'm going too far down these rabbit holes. But fundamentally, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that what we want to do at its most basic is change the way that we think about what is historic in Los Angeles and who are the people who contributed to that history. So we want to change the way that the landmarking process is done, so that it is really forcing people to think about what are the histories associated with this place, to really just looking at the actual physical. They're looking at the architecture. They're looking at the things that you can see and touch, and it's being designated for those kind of material aspects. And we really want to push back on that and say, you need to be exploring what is the history that is embedded in this place, and particularly the women's histories that are embedded in this place. So we're going to start in a couple of ways to do that, to kind of begin that shift, which we know it will take a long time. It's you know, the program's been in existence for 60 years. So this is going to be a slow change, but we want to jumpstart that change in a couple of ways. One is by simply looking at the 1300 existing landmarks. So we know every one of those has women's stories embedded in them. They just aren't being told. And so we started first by just looking at those 1300 and analyzing what are the different ways in which women have been left out of those designations. Right now, the city of Los Angeles doesn't have a way to go back and kind of amend or correct an existing nomination. So we've got 1300 places whose history is kind of frozen at the moment in the way that those it's being recognized. So we're working with the Office of Historic Resources to help change that, to create a process where you can go back and correct and revise something that was listed, whether that was in the late 1960s, when sometimes a nomination was a photograph and a handwritten note, and that's all there was to it.
Oh, okay.
Up to the things that have come in very recently, but maybe were only being recognized for their architecture and not really for the people connected to them and the women connected to them. So that making that change, creating that process, will allow pretty much anyone. We're doing it specifically for women's history, and we're going to be amending a handful of nominations, probably somewhere between 5 and 10, to show how that can be done and set that up as a model for anyone anywhere to come back and say, oh, I know this place. I know this place in my community, in my neighborhood. This place is meaningful to me, and I want to help expand the story, expand the histories that are being told. It also includes all other underrepresented peoples whose stories have not been incorporated into the nominations up until today. In addition to that, we're going to be looking at new nominations to kind of set a model for how you can designate sites of women's history, particularly diverse women's history, LGBTQ, Indigenous women's history, going forward. So we're looking back at the existing nominations, how to fix those. We're looking forward in how to do designations that are very specifically listed for their connections to women. And we're going to be doing, we've already started compiling a list. We've got about 250 places and stories that we've already identified. And we're constantly having conversations with community leaders, organizations, researchers, scholars, activists to get their suggestions for places of women's history that are important to them so that we can essentially build a database of sites that need to be recognized for their connections to women going forward for the next several decades. And then,
wow.
It's an ambitious project. And all of this, we want to, you know, we're kind of the guinea pig here in LA building these processes. But then we very much want to make sure that we are communicating these out, sharing them out, like I said, with any city, with any commission, with any organizational or agency leader anywhere in the country, so that they can follow this model and begin to build more recognition and equity for women into the way that they are doing their work as well.
Right. And will this database then be something that'll be, you know, up on a website? Can people go and look at it and add stories or suggestions? How can people be involved and support this, I'm asking?
Oh, sure. I appreciate that question. So yeah, our goal is to have a online representation of this, most likely in the form of a story map. So it will exist in a couple of different ways. We're hoping to build this database and share it with the Office of Historic Resources and the Cultural Heritage Commission. Those are the two entities within the city of Los Angeles that are responsible for doing these designations. So in some ways, kind of handing over to them, here's a, I don't want to call it a work plan, but here's sort of a set of goals. Here's, you know, 200, 300 places and stories of women's history in Los Angeles that need to be recognized in the coming years as a part of the work that they do. But we also want to have very public facing aspects of this work. Often people will do a designation, it will go into a file or sit on a shelf, and then no one ever sees it again. To us, it's incredibly important that this history be alive, that people have the ability to interact with it and learn from it. And so we're working with the LA Conservancy as a partner in this and want to then use all of this information that we're gathering to create new tours and activities and events, both for adults and for younger people, that are centered around these places and the women stories that we help unearth as a part of this work. We're also really excited about the potential to do work with filmmakers and do short stories and videos and oral histories so people can get little snippets of information about women or places that are of particular interest to them. Those perhaps can become educational tools. We really, at the end of the day, like I mentioned earlier, would love to be able to have curriculum and lesson plans and activities that are specifically aimed at fourth and fifth graders or grade schoolers here in Los Angeles and LAUSD, so that they understand that women were integral to LA's history, that they're learning about these women from the moment that they start learning about their local history.
Right. Yeah, that's huge. And I love all the multiple ways that you're looking to approach this. It's very exciting. Tell us your website so that people, you know, and where else people might be able to follow this work or stay in touch in some way with the work.
So if you're interested in learning more about the National Trust and Where Women Made History or LA Women's Landmarks, you can go to the National Trust website, which is savingplaces.org, and then /women's-history. And that will give you, that will take you straight to our webpage where you can get a nice overview about the Where Women Made History initiative and the work that we're doing across the country to help identify and elevate places where women changed our country and changed, in some instances, changed the world. And there's also additional information that you can get there about the scope of the LA Women's Landmarks Project. You can also get this information from our partner's website at the LA Conservancy, which is www.laconservancy.org. And they also have a special page on the LA Women's Landmarks Project, including a really great short video by one of our interns, our USC interns, Arabella Delgado, who featured some of the specific places that we've identified and have been talking about as being important aspects of women's history here in LA.
We'll definitely go and find that video and share that on our socials as well. I love that. It's been great to talk to you. We've been talking to Chris Morris from the National Trust for Historic Preservation, and we're talking about where women made history, starting right here in LA, but everywhere. Thank you so much, Chris, for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much, Lynn.
LGBTQ Pride Month is a month-long observance dedicated to the celebration of attributions of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer culture and community. Pride Month is observed in June in the United States, coinciding with the anniversary of the 1969 Stonewall Riots, a series of gay liberation protests. The first Pride marches were held in four U.S. cities in June of 1970, 1 year after the riots at the Stonewall Inn. KPFK Radio celebrates the opportunity to wish a happy Pride Month to all.
Hi, Diane here. I'm the co-host of Something's Happening at Midnight on Monday through Thursday, midnight to 6 a.m., with a message from our interim general manager, Maggie DePeake. So you may have noticed some outages in our signal lately, and the reason is our transmitter is really urgently in need of some repairs. Since we're listener-sponsored, we're coming to you. The good news is a generous donor has already donated $25,000, and that will be matched by the rest of us for a total of $50,000. And then our chief engineer, Stu Landau, and longtime KPFK ally and a top radio engineer, Bert Wiener, they'll take care of the rest. We only have until July 31st, so please call that number, 818-985-5735, option 2, or kpfk.org, and click the Fix the Signal banner. Every dollar counts. Thank you in advance for your generosity, keeping us strong and on the air. Let's fix the signal together.
Let the music keep our spirits high. Let the buildings keep our children
high. You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And coming up next...
So reproductive justice is an expansive and revolutionary vision.
In the shadow of debate over elective abortion, we sat down with Dr. Alexis Pauline Gomes to talk about a vision for the future that reaches deep into existing wisdom around care and caregiving. It starts with reading folks like June Jordan and Alice Walker.
She says, mothering is an instinct, yes, but it's also a skill. It can be taught. And she believes that everyone should learn the skills associated with mothering, because that's what we all need in order to actually shift into a life-giving, sustaining relationship to community, planet, life itself.
Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. Abortion is only one piece of a larger conversation about reproduction. The reproductive justice movement started in the mid-1990s by Black and Indigenous women argues, rarely do we find ourselves fighting for just one aspect of reproductive justice, such as abortion rights. We sat down with a daughter of the movement, Dr. Alexis Pauline Gums, to talk about a vision for the path forward. Alexis Pauline Gums is a queer, Black troublemaker and Black feminist love evangelist, founder or the co-founder of several community organizations focused on everything from ending gendered violence to land trust to healing work and all things media. She's a writer with work published in several outlets, 5 books already born, and 1 in gestation called The Eternal Life of Audre Lorde. Alexis is a teacher, making access to regular folks a priority. She founded Brilliance Remastered, an online network and series of retreats and online intensives, serving community accountable intellectuals and artists. I have to ask, does this mean our listeners?
Yes.
Okay, great. So it's very exciting. It seems that the uniting theme of all of her work is a passion for the issues that impact oppressed communities and an intimate knowledge of the resilience of movements led by Black, Indigenous, working class women and queer people of color. Today, we're going to be talking about the book, one of your books, one of your babies that you co-edited with China Martins and Maya Williams. This book is really very truly dear to me. Like, it's my friend. And the book is Revolutionary Mothering, Love on the Front Lines. And if it's okay, I wanted to read some praise from Alice Walker.
Oh, I love that.
Revolutionary Mothering, Love on the Front Lines is juicy, gutsy, vulnerable, and very brave. These women insist on having their children in a society that does not welcome them, in a world that is rapidly falling apart. Their dream for their children, based on their love of them, encompasses the sorrow and the joy that mothers everywhere, whether human, animal, or plant, feel at this time. A radical vision, many radical visions of how to mother in a time of resistance and of pain. There's a beautiful preface in the book by Professor Loretta Ross that it gives it a sort of a rich, almost like sensorial context to the formation of the reproductive justice movement. And in a minute, I am going to ask you to tell me the birth story of the book. But first, I was wondering if you could tell me and our listeners the birth story of the reproductive justice movement.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, so the reason that we are so honored that Loretta Ross could have agreed to write a preface for Revolutionary Mothering is that we definitely know that that work wouldn't have been possible for us, imaginable even outside of the context of a reproductive justice movement. And Loretta Ross is one of the founding mothers of that movement. So reproductive justice is an expansive and revolutionary vision that is about really empowering all of us, but especially the people most impacted by multiple systems of oppression, to have autonomy over what happens with our capacity to create, what happens in terms of our ability to define and create the relationships that we have, the families that we want, the destinies that we want for our own bodies. And its expansiveness is in some way the response of feminists of color, including Loretta Ross, to what they saw as some of the limitations to the idea of reproductive rights, in quotes. And so they wanted to create something that really spoke to the multiple ways that our capacity as beings that create, that needs each other to survive, that lives and relates in units of community, beyond the question of access to abortion or not access to abortion. And also that takes into account the histories of coerced sterilization. It takes into account histories of experimentation with birth control drugs on impoverished women in Puerto Rico. All of these different truth-telling imperatives are part of what makes the reproductive justice movement exist.
I love an intellectual. I have to tell you that. I mean, you know, I'm a nurse, and I don't know if you know other nurses, but, you know, we are very, like, of the earth. And so, like, it is so stimulating to talk to somebody who's kind of the clouds, you know what I mean? Like, in a most, sure. in a lovely way. Because I'm thinking, tell me the birth story. And I'm thinking, it was 1994, and these women gathered in Chicago, and they ate at Chipotle, or, you know, and then, right, they went back to the South. And they formed Sister Song, right?
Yes. Also, there's a really important essay in an anthology called The Color of Violence that Insight Women of Color Against Violence published, where Loretta Ross writes her definition of reproductive justice, which I would refer everyone to, because that is for me, that's the best way to hear that origin story, aside from if you're very blessed and get to just listen to Loretta Ross or Billy Avery themselves. So there's Sister Song was really the space to say, like, to sing what reproductive justice is and to roll that out into the world. And Loretta Ross was the founding executive director of Sister Song. Mm. And the Sister Song conferences, the Let's Talk About Sex conferences, became this catalyzing movement space. One of the things that they did that I love is that they had mother-daughter fellowships to go to the conference. And so my mother and I went to Sister Song in Chicago.
That is so beautiful.
Together. I think that at the core of reproductive justice is, and I've heard Loretta Ross recently talk about this as like a reproductive futurity, is that it is intergenerational. It lives in intergenerationality. And they have moved that way the entire time. So in Atlanta, there's a place called Mother House. And this was it's really a house. It was the headquarters for Black, give a corner to the story, which really probably only I can tell you. When I was a teenage writer growing up in Atlanta, I went to Mother House to the basement to lead a writing workshop and facilitate the creation of a newsletter, like a newsletter about sex for the teenagers. And I was a teenager. They were like children who were part of the summer program that Black Women's Health Project had as part of its initiative for there to be intergenerational conversations about sex and profoundly comprehensive sex education. And so that was actually the first time that as a writer facilitator, I ever was paid to facilitate a writing workshop, which to me keys into this idea of reproductive justice movement generating our creativity in all these multiple ways, right? And then the children, who many of them were children of these same reproductive justice movement workers, just were having these incredible conversations about sexuality and gender and fluidity and justice and autonomy and consent, like all blessing to be able to have an intergenerational view on that from a young age.
It's so cool that you had such a front row seat.
Yeah.
And like how neat that it really ties into the book, I feel like, because a lot of the book that you co-edited is talking about the actual work of mothering as revolutionary work itself. And so this idea that your mother was taking you to these places, she was raising a revolutionary. I mean, look at you now, you know, like she did the work, you know, and now look at you like putting it out into the world in even bigger, further ways. What's the birth story of this book?
Oh, yay. Okay. So it goes back to a internet love story. My would-be future co-editor, Maya, and I met on the internet, and I think we both have been making zines for a long time. We blog, and I think we found each other that way. And Maya was wanting to use a workbook I had made with these women in South Africa who had taken over an abandoned factory to create their own school with their children. And I was like, what? Who is this person? But so Maya is an international human rights worker and journalist. And she, while we were cultivating our friendship, she was traveling all over the world and she was organizing with mothers. She was organizing with moms who were part of the Zapatista movement. She was organizing with moms who were part of the Arab Spring uprising. She was organizing in Palestine, and in all of these spaces, she was telling me what was going on and the revolution.
She was finding the moms.
She was finding the moms, yeah. And she already had a really clear understanding that that is revolutionary. And then she started to create this zine called Revolutionary Motherhood. Meanwhile, I am in the archive researching. I'm working on my PhD, and my dissertation is called We Can Learn to Mother Ourselves, The Queer Survival of Black Feminism. And so I'm looking at everything that these feminists of color are saying about mothering in the 1980s, 1970s and 1980s. And so I'm looking through Audre Lorde's papers. I'm looking through June Jordan's papers. I'm looking through finding these Azalea and the Salsa Soul Sister Gazette and, you know, all of these out of print publications that are basically ancestors to our zines that we're creating. And I'm telling her what I find, right? And so she's like, listen to what happened in Gaza. And I'm like, listen to what June Jordan said in 1977, you know? And this conversation that we're having is actually a real conversation. Like, we are meant to put together this archive and legacy of a revolutionary approach to mothering and contemporary people who should create an anthology. This is our idea. And then we met China Martins, who's our would-be co-editor, at the Allied Media Conference. And China's like almost a generation older than Maya and I. China is like zine's forerunner. Like, she was the first person to write mothering zines about being a mother, about raising a kid on welfare. She was really the first. And The Future Generation is the name of her zine. And so we were like, yes, you know, like this is our trifecta dream team. At the beginning, we thought we were going to call it This Bridge Called My Baby. And when we sent out our call for submissions, that's what we said. And we're creating an anthology called This Bridge Called My Baby. So many people sent in essays and poems and stories. And we were like, whoa, this is amazing. And we started this process of the intensive work of creating an anthology. And it took like 7 years before it actually existed in print. Anyway, so the reason that we created this book was because we really felt that there was something to be said about, again, intergenerationally, what really to shine light on a revolutionary approach to mothering, right? Because we're very clear, like, we're not creating that. It's something very, very old.
Mm-hmm.
It's really important to us that, we were like over the moon, ready to pass out when Alice Walker wrote that blurb, because her erratic motherism, it talks about mothering as a form of being in the world and really as the ethical form of being in the world, and that it can include everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a line in that essay where she says, mothering is an instinct, yes, but it's also a skill. It can be taught. And she believes that everyone should learn the skills associated with mothering, because that's what we all need in order to actually shift into a life-giving, sustaining relationship to community, planet, life itself. And so the deepest thing that we wanted recognition for all of this revolutionary labor that we're naming as revolutionary mothering that has been happening for generations, and without which certainly the three of us wouldn't exist. And it's possible to think that maybe life wouldn't exist, right? There are these constant acts of life-giving and care that, because they exist right up against these forms of oppression that have seemingly done everything to eradicate them.
Wow, that's quite a birth story.
Yes, thank you for asking.
Well, I have to tell you, like, the reason why I reached out to you recently about about doing this interview and talking about this book that was published in 2016. You know, it's not like there's like a timely stamp on this or whatever, right. Except that there is.
Right.
Because I am Indiana by lesbian pastors. I have this, my raising, that is during times of stress or confusion, like to go to text. Protestants love their Bible study. So I don't really turn to the Bible, but I go to my bookshelf. And I feel like all of our different states and communities are pretty much trying to decide who they are.
Yeah.
I mean, I have not heard the word abortion so much ever in my life before being discussed openly.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to know, are there other things that you think people could be reading right now as they're kind of grappling with whatever is happening in their communities?
I mean, of course, Kerr is somebody who to always read, but I would say especially her essay. When we think about abortion, she's somebody who's been very open about the fact that this is a part of her experience and her early politicization as a young woman, a young college student, and she has this expansive perspective that I draw on over and over again. So read more Alice Walker. June Jordan, definitely. And I'll just say the essay that we were so honored to print in Revolutionary Mothering is called The Creative Spirit in Children's Literature. And this is the place where June Jordan makes the proclamation that love is life force. And this is a talk that she gave at a conference about children's literature at Berkeley in California in 1977. And the first sentence is just, love is life force. That's it. The end. Like, that's everything right there. And she goes on to offer this incredible, expansive definition of what creativity is, what creation is, and how it exists. And then she talks about the accountability of what our intergenerational conversation is. For June Jordan is what is the possible conversation we can have between generations? And she just goes deep into like, what is it? What are the fears that brings up in adults? What's disrespectful about not talking about certain things with young people?
And before we get away from it, I do want to, if it's okay, I want to read like just a very short piece from this essay that you're making reference to, if it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
June Jordan says, and it seems to me that love, that is serious and tender concern to respect the nature and the spontaneous purpose of other things, other people, order among us, such that fear, conflict, competition, waste, and environmental sacrifice will have no place. That passage means a lot. It's like, that's everything. Like, what else is there
that's
to say?
That's everything, like right? Said. It's everything yeah. that we need. Like, we would do this one thing.
Yeah.
We would do this one thing.
We could just like live like this. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that I can never get too much of June Jordan. So I turn to so many. I turn to Angela Davis. I turn to my dear sister, Adrienne Marie Brown. I turn to Walida E. Marisha. I turn, of course, to Loretta Ross. So I'm a creative writing editor at the journal Feminist Studies, and there's a resource on the Feminist Studies website that, in response to the Supreme Court decision, that we decided to create, and it kind of chronicles, because this is an issue that is in the journal all the time. But it chronicles an archive going back, it's 50 years that this journal has existed. You can look at that to give kind of a long view of how feminist thinkers have been writing about this over time. There's so much reading to do.
We're jumping in to remind you that you are listening to Making Contact, and an interview with Dr. Alexis Pauline Gums. Visit us online at radioproject.org, where you can join the conversation with a comment. And now back to the show. you know, we've talked about reading, we've talked about holding workshops. Is there anything else that you're doing to find hope right now, or kind of manage yourself and your community?
Yeah, I think the other things on a smaller scale has just been more reaching out, you know, like I have kind of had to get over it. And even me being like, oh, nobody wants to really hear from me, or, oh, I can't, you know, like, let me stay within the boundary of not reaching out even to people I do know, or like my own friends, you know, like that's been a thing that I've struggled with. And now I see, I'm like, oh, that's complicit in the forms of isolation that those who would harm all of us want to exist, so that we don't acknowledge our collective power, right? And act accordingly. And so that's definitely been a way. I am not a nurse, but I'm like a major distributor of just raspberry leaf to people, you know, like it's just I'm like, this will help. You know, I have my little peppermint raspberry leaf.
Your tinctures and your witchy
the tea,
brews.
You know, all of that. And and also just that practice for myself, you know, I mean, it's tied to what Loretta Ross is talking about, this legacy of us taking care of ourselves and each other and learning what that takes in relationship with the natural world.
Taking care of yourself is revolution. Taking care of your children is revolution. As a mom of human babies, it doesn't always feel that way, because it is work that is unseen and unappreciated by capitalism completely. And so it, you know, to all you moms out there, keep your head up like you're doing it.
Yes.
And to all the people who are doing mothering work, it's important work too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that that's one of the things that our dream for revolutionary mothering includes. It's to say that the exact isolation that you're talking about, where capitalism pretends to not value the labor of mothering, but it needs it.
It needs it. It
at the same time,
doesn't it?
Right.
Doesn't it?
That is what we want to shine a light on. All of those acts of care, the disgusting, you know, someone spitting up on you, you know, all those things are happening. Those are, and what would a world be like where we valued that in such a way that the actual labor of it wasn't isolated either, right? And that is, in fact, dangerous to capitalism. It's certainly dangerous to any system that would want to disempower anyone, but particularly disempower women, because, there's too much love. There's too much love and creativity. And when we collaborate on it,
that's some powerful stuff.
That's it. Love is life force.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
So thank you so much for having me.
I've been your host, Amy Gastelum.
And we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. Feminist Magazine is produced by a coalition of feminist volunteers. You can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. Find us on Facebook and on Instagram, or just email us at feministmagazine@yahoo.com. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. You can find our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play. Thanks for listening.
Please don't do this to me. Yes! Come on, come on, come on, come on! Yes, yes, yes! Come on! Oh! God, son of a piece of... Ugh! I give up.
If that old junker in your driveway is a lost cause, you can always donate it to KPFK through our auto donation program. It's as simple as calling 877-KPFK-AUTO and asking the operator to assist you in arranging for a pickup. We'll tow it away, and we'll mail you all the necessary paperwork for you to write it off of your taxes. Call us now at 877-KPFK-AUTO or donate online at kpfk.org by clicking Pledge Support.